He was born in 1801 in London. His father was a relatively well-off banker. His mother came from a wealthy Huguenot family. He was the eldest of six children, two brothers and three sisters. And then when he was about 15, he said that he had a very strong belief that he'd met God through Jesus, almost like what we would call a vision or a very, very intense experience. And at that point, he decided that he wanted to become a very convinced Christian and he wanted to do something with his life. But he was leaving school. He'd been in Great Ealing School, which was one of the premier boarding schools in London at the time. And he went off to university, and his father, who drove up in the pony and trap with him, said, "It'll depend which way the horse goes." And the horse apparently turned towards Oxford, so that's how he headed off to Oxford. He enrolled in Trinity, but around the same time, his father's bank failed because of the Napoleonic Wars, and there was a lot of confusion at that time. So suddenly they went from being a reasonably well-off family to being on the borders of financial ruin, and it was very, very difficult for him. Anyway, he got a scholarship to study at Trinity College. He decided he wanted to become what we call a tutor, and he applied for Oriel College, which at that time had been one of the premier colleges in Oxford, and in fact it was increasing in its reputation because it had gone down in until about the 1780s, and then a group of very good academics had taken over at this stage. So Newman applied, and he thought, well, I won't get the post in my first application, but maybe I will after two or three goes. But he was accepted immediately. He was delighted with that, and from that time onwards, it meant that he could remain living in the college, and the path was that probably he'd become a clergyman. So Newman got what was called the living of St. Mary the Virgin in the centre of Oxford, and he had a very interesting impact on the students, because he argued that as a tutor, he wasn't just to try and help the young people to learn about the facts and the scientific things about his subjects, but he was also to try and make them a better person. So he had a very strong belief that he had to have a moral impact on their lives. In 1848, he'd a problem because the government, the Robert Peel government, had been making various changes within society. But one of the things they were doing was suppressing dioceses. That meant that they might amalgamate or suppress the diocese. And Newman was thinking, because he was a very good patristic scholar, in one of his summer holidays, he'd read all the Latin and Greek works of the early fathers. Now, I don't know anybody who's done that ever since, but that's what he did. You know, we don't have that scholarship, unfortunately, nowadays. So he said, but how can that be? Because only bishops should be involved in this, and only they should be the ones who would make the change within a diocese. So that began to crack the vision of the Anglican Church, which he had. Now, he accepted that the Anglican Church, the Church of England, had been created through the schism of Henry VIII, who was trying to get a successor for the throne, Henry of the Six Wives. And he also tried to come up with what he called the three-branch argument, whereby you would say that the truth of the Christian faith is found within the Catholic, Anglican, and Orthodox churches. So he would have no problem with them. But the more he studied this, the more he felt uneasy with the position of the Church of England, so much so that in mid-age, when he's in his mid-40s, he decided to convert to Catholicism. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to do in those days, because when you think about it, they, for example, they had to pay a tithe to the Anglican clergy, they had to support the Anglican upper class, if you like, and the Catholics were generally, for the most part, they were a poorer amount of people. They didn't have the great titles, they didn't have the land, all of that had been taken under the Henrician reforms. So for Newman to turn around and suddenly announce that he was going to leave the Church of England, which he did in the first place, and then he took a couple of years to think where he'd go and what he'd do, and then to finally announce that he was going to become a Catholic, which he did at 44, he decided that he would join the Catholic Church. In his own family terms, he had a lot of difficulties because his two brothers were, well, he always found they were eccentric. He thought they were eccentric, and he didn't get on with either of them particularly well. And one of them, Charles, was actually very, very eccentric, and they had a very peculiar relationship. John Henry had lost his favourite sister, Mary, when she was in her 20s. She died quite suddenly of an illness. And he'd still two sisters left, and one of them, Harriet, didn't speak to him after his conversion until she died a few years later. So it caused an extraordinary rift within the family. Mm. And he had to accept that. And also a great number of his friends no longer talked to him, even though they lived in Oxford. They crossed the other side of the street.
I mean, he was essentially socially isolating himself. I mean, did he predict that? Did he know that that would happen? Or was he, do you think, surprised by the extremity of the reaction?
I'd say he was surprised and disappointed, yes. I don't think any of the converts at that time really expected that they were going to have to deal with such personal animosity. But he took it on the chin. And interestingly, very often in his writings, I mean, he was an extraordinarily prolific writer. He was also very disappointed that not only his friends let him down, but even the Catholic Church that he joined didn't really support him in the way that it should have. And I'll give you an example. Shortly after he converted and he went to Rome, he was ordained in 1847, he came back to England. He decided that he'd join the Oratorians. And he said, I'll set up a little oratory where I'll have maybe half a dozen priests. We'll all live together. We'll work in a parish. We'll also do academic work. So we'll combine the best of all worlds. And that's what he did. But shortly after he set up the oratory in Birmingham, he was invited to come over to Ireland to set up the Catholic University. I think the Catholic authorities from Rome were looking at it like this. In England, there's been a lot of people crossing the bridge and coming over from the Anglican Church to the Catholic Church. The laws have been relaxed. Is this not time for us really to set up things and get ourselves organized? And in 1850, Pope Pius IX re-established the bishops, the hierarchy, in England. At the same time in Ireland, the bishops were also getting a shot in the arm. And one of the shots was the appointment of Paul Cullen as Archbishop of Armagh in 1850. He'd been rector of the Irish College. He'd lived in Rome since he was 17, actually, as a student, and then had spent most of his life in Rome since then. And he was appointed to Armagh. And then shortly afterwards, a couple of years later, he came down to succeed Archbishop Daniel Murray in Dublin. But he went over to Birmingham to meet Newman, and he asked him would he be willing to set up a Catholic university. By that stage, Cullen was moving down to Dublin, and Newman decided that he'd set up his small little university between Harcourt Street and St. Stephen's Green, and he got the leases on some houses. Cullen was, you know, very supportive, and he said, but at the same time, you're going to have to go around the bishops of Ireland, Dr. Newman, to try and get the money. And Newman headed off and he visited a load of bishops around the country and was entertained in convents and put up in religious houses, etc. But he was very disappointed that none of the bishops really put their hands in their pocket to help him out. And they had so little money anyway. The Catholics were extremely impoverished, the majority of them. The Catholic bourgeoisie under Daniel O'Connell hadn't really taken off. It was only just fledgling at that stage. And Newman was saying, yes, but we want to educate the next generation to take their place within society. And interestingly enough, a lot of the Catholic people were saying, well, we only want to get our sons. And remember, the sons went to university, girls didn't go. What we really need is to get our sons educated so they can get decent jobs. And they had very low ambitions at that stage. They'd have been happy for them to get any lower paid civil service job. But Ireland was still under British rule and was to remain so until the 20th century. So at that stage, Newman was developing his idea of the university, which he gave in a series of speeches at the Rotunda in Dublin, and then he later on published it as a book called The Idea of the University. And he was saying, university isn't just to provide little pieces on a machine which will become work. It's not to supply the factories and to supply everything. The idea of the university is to help you to become an integrated person, to be a fully developed human, to develop your potential. And that's what it's all about. So I think the Irish were probably more pragmatic, and they wanted to, understandably, to try and make money out of this. And Newman also was very disappointed because Cullen didn't really help him. Cullen, now at this stage, had landed in Dublin. Dublin was the premier city of the country. But it was also in a shambles. When Cullen arrived over, there was no list of the clergy in Armagh. So when Cullen came along, he was coming the white knight in shining armour from Rome, and he was setting this all up, and he's a superb organiser. And he did the same when he was transferred down to Dublin, and he was almost setting up his empire. Now, in the book, I regret, when I was doing this little book on Newman, I probably was a little bit hard on Cullen, because subsequently, more that I've read, I come to a better understanding that Cullen really was trying to redress a terrible injustice which had been forced by the British authorities. And he was really trying to put order and discipline also in the clergy. So Newman came from a very different background. He had been in the Anglican church tradition for so long, which was very well disciplined and ordered, and he couldn't cope, I think. I'm beginning to go against Newman, whom I love, but I'm beginning to be much more sympathetic to Cullen, because Cullen, you see, was building up his little empire. He founded 20 parishes or so in the time he was in Dublin. He also set up the seminary, Holy Cross College, at the same time that the university was being set up by poor old Newman on the Green, and Newman was driven daft. Unfortunately, things didn't really go well for him, because relationships between Cullen and Newman broke down. I think Cullen was driven daft with this little Englishman poking his nose in every time there's a problem. And in the correspondence on one occasion, I remember reading Newman being very peaky and saying that Dr. Cullen would no longer receive him in his rooms. So you can imagine what relationship they're at that stage. So he went back to Birmingham, carried on setting up his oratory, and he published a book, the Apologia Pro Vita Sua, which is a seminal book, very important book, in the 1860s. And that was very interesting, because it really opened the door back to so many of his Anglican friends, who had to review their situation and say, were we very unfair to break off our relationships? And he also is reviewing his relationships. And from that time onwards, many of his friends, you know, began to make tentative contact with him again.